Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, attorney Heidi Boghossian, about her recent book, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. But first, we speak with educator and activist Cindy Pakulas to talk about the pushback on the Common Core education reform. Common Core is a curriculum created in the private sector, but pushed onto states by the federal government and endorsed by Bill Gates. The cost of implementing the program runs from millions to billions, depending on the state. It is untested and unresearched. It has been criticized for being not as rigorous as proponents claim. It is being forced on the states in spite of the fact that a federal curriculum is unconstitutional, violating the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which established the principle that the power to oversee education belongs to the states. This long-standing principle of local control of education is reiterated throughout our laws and government codes. Cindy Pakulas, welcome back to Another News.
Hi, it's great to be back, Jeff.
Well, a lot's been going on, and usually when you're on the show, we're talking about geoengineering and the aerosol operations up in the atmosphere. Although that's been going on intensely lately, something else has been happening, and that's Common Core education reform, something you've been also looking at very closely. Can you tell listeners what that is?
Well, Common Core is federally mandated and funded, basically change to the entire education system in the United States. I think something like 45 states have signed on, but 15, thank God, are now questioning it and possibly backing out of it. Hmm. And what it really is that, I believe it's called also Race to the Top, mm-hmm. It's new standards that are being put in across the nation, and I like the standards. They're things that our children hopefully could be able to do, should be able to do. But the problem is standards are put in and teachers and school districts and schools, for that matter, are supposed to have the freedom to implement these standards however they see fit. Mm-hmm. What's happening, though, is, of course, the corporations are involved, and Pearson is a major corporation, and they're basically supplying a lot of the materials. And where parents are starting to get involved is they're looking at these materials, and they're not liking what they're seeing. Some of them are saying, you know, the president makes the laws, he's very smart, we must follow the president. It's not something that you want children, especially children, in kindergarten, first and second grade, to be indoctrinated.
Can I stop you there mm-hmm. for a second? The president of the United States makes the laws. It's what it's asserting. There's no judicial,
absolutely.
Legislative.
Absolutely. And actually, if you sign onto Facebook, and we all know the horrors of Facebook, but it is a means to get the word out like everything else. It's such a dichotomy in today that we're living in. Mm-hmm. But there are so many Common Core groups by parents, by school teachers, by principals that are actually posting all the things that the children are being asked to do in school. And we were supposed to have the say being educators and being school districts, but what's happening is that school districts are buying all the materials, and there's a couple of reasons for that, because the school districts had to buy into this to get the funding. So there's also lawsuits that are starting to come up as to whether or not this is coercion, and also the federal government getting involved with the education of the states, which is also against the law. So there's a lot of good lawsuits that are being initiated, but teachers haven't had a chance to be trained and to learn, and the students are now being tested on it. And most of the students failed last year, the test, because they're set at such a high level, because the premise is that they need to be college and career ready. So what they've set it at is something like, by the time a student graduates, they'll be able to get 1630 on the SAT, where prior to that, or the actual level that is really realistic, would be 1530. So what you're doing is you're creating a divide between those that can make this and the majority that can't. And when they can't now, it's mandated. If they fail these tests, they go into reading, they go into math. So as they get into high school, any of the liberal arts, any other courses that is available to them, they can't take. So you're going to have a very robotic nation that just really doesn't know the liberal arts, doesn't, the creative part of their brain isn't going to be utilized or in high school. What jobs are they going to get? And it's even more than that, because New York has signed on to an in-bloom cloud database system. In fact, a lot of Florida, their Department of Education, I believe, is looking at it and is possibly throwing it out. Sachem School District, it was already bought, and a lot of the students' personal records, medical records, have been released to corporations. So New York has signed on to this, and there's really, they kind of guarantee that, you know, none of these records are going to be sold to nefarious parties and everything's going to be kept personal, but they don't really have the grounds to implement that yet because this is done so quickly. So what could possibly or feasibly happen is that your child's education records, if they have a disability, if they need special services, if they need anything from the grades of kindergarten through fourth or fifth grade, a corporation could see and could decide, well, we're not going to hire this individual because we might have to supply them with extra services, and colleges can start to pick and choose what child they might want to have by the time that they're third grade, depending on if they're in special education.
So corporations will have personal data on the students from kindergarten through high school. Right now on YouTube, there's a lot of community meetings and people speaking out to the New York Education Commissioner, King. What's being said in those meetings?
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, as we've worked together numerous times to try to get the word out about geoengineering, I'm floored. I'm especially floored at the way Long Island is really chomping at the bit over this, which is fantastic. In fact, Commissioner King had started a couple of meetings, I guess, maybe 3 months ago, and it wasn't down here. I believe it was upstate. But he stopped. He said, I'm not doing this. It was overrun by special interest groups. And, of course, that ended up not doing him very well because the special interest groups that were disagreeing with him and asking questions were the parents. So a couple of senators on Long Island, one senator in particular, started calling for his resignation over the fact that you don't want to meet with the parents. You implement this whole new system. Nobody is really asked. And now, because the parents are disagreeing with you and asking questions, you stop meetings. So he started meetings again.
He stopped the meetings and he called the parents a special interest group?
Oh, yeah. It was overrun by special interest groups.
It's what he said.
Is what he said.
In reality, what was really going on?
The parents were furious over these new tests. So, like, for example, my son has gotten fours on all his standardized tests in math and in English. And he was in seventh grade last year, and he just made a three. Had he scored 2 points lower on the test, here he is in honors and very smart in math, up through seventh grade, he would have needed to be pulled out for math services. This year, he's in eighth grade, and he's taking the new Common Core algebra, which is also ninth grade algebra, and I have to tell you, he is struggling. This is a student who never struggled before, and now he's struggling in math, and the stress that is being put on these children is tremendous. Now, my son is in eighth grade. There are children in kindergarten and in pre-K who are doing worksheets and are coming home having to fill these things out. The joy of childhood is all of a sudden disappearing before our eyes, and that's one of the things that the parents are upset about. And the director, the education secretary for Obama, Arnie Duncan, he actually made a quote in a paper that he had to rescind and apologize for because he said it's just suburban moms who, and he might have even said white moms, I'm not sure though, It's just suburban moms who are upset that their children basically aren't the geniuses that they thought they were. However, the stakes are being put so high, not even us, the children, no one's been prepared. Like, this should be implemented over a couple of years. If I don't even think it should be implemented, because the other thing that they're stating, all the proponents who have put this together, is that it's based on testing. There is no testing to prove that this could work. What kind of endeavor should be put forth in the education of our children if it hasn't been verified and tested and absolutely confirmed that what they're doing is working? And then on that, just to segue into another area of concern, Arnie Duncan, the education secretary, has never been a teacher. Commissioner King, I think, taught as a teacher and then for 3 years, and then he opened up a school. And they said that they would have teachers' input, and basically I know quite a few teachers who did give input into this. And Pearson, the company who stands to make billions, they didn't take what the teachers, the input that they gave in. In fact, the teachers felt like all they were doing was accumulating what the teacher said so that they could put it into a standardized test question format. And even on that note, I mean, as we've talked many times about the Gates Foundation, well, just recently it was in the paper how the CEO of the Gates Foundation, and I don't remember the lady's name, is leaving that so-called nonprofit organization, and now she's going to be the CEO of Pearson, which is the corporation that is supplying all the testing materials and stands to make billions. And the Gates Foundation has put out, because Bill Gates is 100% behind this and, of course, supporting it and funding it, that, you know, she really wants to work with people to get this on track, the Gates Foundation. They want feedback from parents. And that's because it's bubbling at the surface. I mean, we have a meeting our senator sent out to the 30 superintendents in District 1, where my school district falls, on Tuesday at my high school. It's in the gymnasium, and 1,000 people can fit, and they're opening up another part to fit another 1,000 people. And like I said, the senator sent out requests to all the superintendents, please have your people basically come. So, I mean, there's an opt-out of Common Core. There was a Keep Your Children Home Day, I believe, a week ago. Bishop on Long Island has stated, don't do Common Core. A bunch of principals just sent another letter this week to the New York State about their, you know, concerns over Common Core. Everyone seems to be getting on board because you're seeing the effect of children. One teacher, actually, I don't know if it was at Mineola, was saying how the psychologist in her school are calling it a new syndrome, the Common Core syndrome. And just speaking as an educator, the way teachers are feeling now, because everything's been put on us, you know, like we've got to lift the kids up. And just like geoengineering is, you know, the elephant in the room, it absolutely astounds me. I think it's something like 1 out of 3 children has a disability right now. And I believe the quoted numbers are 1 out of 50 is autistic. But if you make yourself familiar with those numbers, the actual organizations that deal with autism are stating it about 1 out of 30. 3 years ago, it was 1 out of 300. 10 years ago, it was 1 out of 10,000. Hmm. You're asking children to perform at such high levels, and unfortunately, and actually horrifically so, so many children have a disability. How is this possible? Well, it's possible if you blame the teachers and you say, you know, they're not teaching right, they need to relearn how to teach. I'm teaching 17 years, so what are you telling me? Everything I've done prior to this is wrong? So it's a scapegoat, and once again, what is wrong that our children have such disabilities that 1 out of 30 has autism? Like, maybe we should check into, well, geoengineering, vaccines, and all of the adjuvants that are in vaccines, fluoride, aluminum, all the horrific things that affect the central nervous system. But no, if you bring anything up like that, oh, God, you're a conspiracy theorist. You know, even to use those terms, you're not a conspiracy theorist. You're the thinker. What is causing this with our children? So now let's put in federally funded program that everyone has to follow. And New York and other states have also put in what's called APPR, where they evaluate the teachers on like a 30-point system. You're ineffective, you're effective, and you're highly effective. And no one can really get highly effective. Well, you can, but, you know, what they're asking you to do to be highly effective, it's blame the teachers, and the teachers are just struggling to try to get this in and to keep their jobs and do what this Common Core curriculum is asking them to do. And thank God the teachers and the principals and the parents are finally, you know, they're banding together saying, what is happening? And attorneys are getting involved, like I said before, because the federal government is not supposed to get into the state's education system. And it's a lot of the poor districts that are jumping on this because of the money. And there was somewhat coercion there, because if you didn't sign on for it, you didn't get the extra funding. And with today's economy, how, you know, all over the island, they're laying off teachers because of funding, because of the money. And unfortunately, it's in the arts. So this goes right along with it. If you can't pass the English and the math test, well, you can't take these extra classes. Well, they're getting rid of them anyway. So when you look at everything and you connect the dots, it's all connected.
You pointed out the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And as we know, they are funding geoengineering research, and they're behind a lot of the vaccine programs in Africa.
Exactly.
And in this country, I believe, as well. Listeners obviously see a pattern here, and the wonderful Bill and Melinda Gates, Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft. What would Steve Jobs say about that right now, I wonder? So, Cindy, there's a pushback. What do you see happening substantially with this pushback?
I feel very optimistic about it. One of the things that just happened is that a Louisiana teachers union has asked, please put a hold on this until we, you know, as far as the teacher evaluations, we need to check into this. Alabama has opted out of Common Core. One district on Long Island, Middle Island, has said no, and they are not using the teacher evaluation system. You know, I really thought it was going to be the autism rate that got the moms involved mm-hmm. and that got people involved, but I don't know. I really think something big is on the horizon because this is very similar to what happened in Nazi Germany. You take over the education system and it's done. I'm very optimistic. I cannot believe the amount of people and the people from different areas that are banding together. I see that this could possibly be something that's thrown out, at least given totally, totally revamped in New York State. But like I said, other states that aren't as, what's the word I'm looking for, that don't follow along as easily as New York.
Cindy Pakulas, we're going to go now to listen to a clip of a community meeting on Long Island. This is something that you sent to me a while back. Can you briefly set this up?
Educator in Long Island that basically came to the meeting to discuss Common Core with Commissioner King and told him that she had petitions for his resignation and that he failed. She actually was the one that spoke about the Common Core syndrome with her students who were so upset about the extra testing. It's just so eloquent the way that she phrased everything.
Cindy Pakulas, thank you so much for being on In Other News and giving us an update on the pushback against Common Core education reform here in Long Island, New York. Cindy Pakulas, once again, as listeners know, is with Long Island Skywatch and frequent guest on the show. Thank you again very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, let's have a listen to that clip.
Teacher in the state of New York, and as such, I am a mandated reporter. And I'm here to report that we are abusing children in the state of New York. There is now a Common Core syndrome.
Yeah.
Do you understand what that means? We have children that are being diagnosed by psychologists with a syndrome directly related to work that they do in the classroom. If that's not child abuse, I don't know what is. I'm very happy, Ms. Tisch, that you are here because I have 50 letters with me and I've mailed you 300 others asking for Mr. King's resignation and fire. By anyone. I was judged as highly effective last year, as Dr. Joe Rilla can attest to. Obviously, Mr. King, you're ineffective. 70% of the children in this state failed your test. I appreciate, Mr. Flanagan, that you're listening, but I'm not sure you're hearing. So what I'm going to tell you is, because you've awoken the mommies, you're in trouble. What's going to happen is that hundreds of thousands of mommies are going to fill out this form, and they are going to have their children refuse to take the test. Because the mommies in New York don't abuse children, and they're not going to let bullies do that
either. We're living in a country with full knowledge that its government and corporations have been allowed to access private data of its citizens. A critical breach in any democracy. Personal computer data, financial and travel data, information about your relationships, your buying habits, what you eat, are some examples of what's being collected and stored in databases about you. How is knowledge of the surveillance state affecting people's behavior, our culture, and the so-called democracies around the world. Our guest, attorney Heidi Boghossian, has written a powerful book titled Spying on Democracy: Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. She's detailed how the government acquires your information from many sources, such as telecommunications companies, and compiles a digital dossier on you. All of this information can then be pulled up by the authorities at any time for any reason without your knowledge. The media is saturated with stories on the many aspects of government surveillance and corporate spying. Many are outraged. Some are indifferent. And meanwhile, corporations are making a profit. Big profits. Some argue we've traded our privacy for the two magic selling points, security and convenience. Are we to blame? Did we create this ourselves? If so, could we undo it, or is it too late? But also, what has it done to our ability to dissent and become effective activists? Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild and co-host of Law and Disorder Radio, attorney Heidi Boghossian, welcome to Another News.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jeff.
Well, you put together this book in the last year chronicling how our private information, such as buying habits, emails, phone calls, travel, are no longer private. What compelled you to write this book?
I've been working with the National Lawyers Guild for nearly 15 years, monitoring how law enforcement and sometimes private entities conduct surveillance on activists across the country. And we've done this at large mass assemblies in different cities, but also at national special security events, the NATO summit, the Republican and Democratic national conventions. And we've seen a pattern of FBI agents and others visiting the homes and the office places of activists who have known to either attend such events or who have spoken out in their communities about certain issues. So law enforcement treatment of individuals who criticize corporate and government policies has always interested me. I started to write the book thinking that I would focus on that because there are a lot of issues involved, not just animal rights and environmental activists. Your listeners may know that the FBI has called those the top domestic terrorism threat. And more recently, we've seen the so-called anarchist threat, which is much more general and could encompass virtually anyone who goes to a protest. So I started doing that, but then I realized as I started writing, corporate surveillance wasn't just of activists. In fact, when you start looking at the surveillance apparatus of outdoor surveillance cameras from Wall Street to Midtown Manhattan, paid for often by private businesses and often in conjunction with local police departments, I started to realize, well, when you go out, pretty much everything you do is being monitored. I actually kept a journal one day. I tried to document every interaction I had, be it at an ATM machine, getting on the subway to go to work, walking into my building, being in the elevator and knowing there were cameras watching me. And that made me start developing different chapters, which really covered categories of things like spying on lawyers, spying on journalists, even children. What I did was try to explain the different ways that subsections of our society are monitored and also controlled to a certain extent, and also document how knowing that we are under surveillance can make us act differently in terms of how we interact with others.
That's what I think is very intriguing about your book. You and I have known because we've worked together for a number of years now on Law and Disorder. And you're one of the hosts of Law and Disorder, and I've been producing it with you. And we see each other a lot. We talk about this stuff a lot. We've known for many years that we're under surveillance. And this is prior to Snowden's story. What do you now see in terms of the changes in people's behavior now that it's known in the mainstream media that they're spying on everything?
Well, I'd like to go back a few years before these broad-based revelations, because a few years ago, under the George W. Bush administration, we had a program of warrantless wiretapping. at that time, and before the general public knew about it, what happened was the government actually gave telecommunication companies, Verizon, AT&T, immunity from being sued. And when the programs became more public knowledge, organizations such as the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, brought lawsuits alleging that legal organizations in particular were having what we call the chilling effect, so that when they talked to controversial clients, inmates at Guantanamo or families of those inmates, because they would have to go visit them actually to talk to them, but when they had communications related to legal representation, knowing that their conversations on the telephone or their email communications might be subject to government monitoring obviously had them alter what they said on the phone. In the case of CCR, for example, attorneys had to often travel to other countries, incur greater expenses in doing their work, and be very careful about trying to maintain the attorney-client privilege. That was also so with the way that they communicated with members of the press. So that's one specific example of how a very cherished privilege, the attorney-client privilege, the right to have those conversations in private, was altered, and how people had to change the method of doing their daily work. Now, obviously, that's a very narrow example, but I think when the general public starts to realize records of, you know, who you talk to on the telephone, even if the government and corporations aren't recording contents of your communication, by the gathering of so-called metadata, the record of John called Jane on a Saturday night, or John called a cancer clinic, Jane called an abortion clinic, obviously the government can glean a lot of personal information that you might not willingly want to give over. So we have to really encourage people to open their minds, and instead of saying, I have nothing to hide, well, would you willingly hand over the fact that you might have cancer, or would you like your employer to know that you belong to a particular political organization, or that you go out and watch UFOs, for example, and record that? A lot of people don't want that known by everyone in their lives. They want to know who to share it with. So I think that what hopefully is happening is in public discourse about the very different ways that we're being monitored, individuals will start to realize, I would like to have personal autonomy and be able to decide what the government knows about me. And certainly what corporations are gathering and then selling to third parties, be it other data aggregators or intelligence agencies within the U.S. government.
We're speaking with Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild and author of the book, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. We'll be right back after this break. Just tuning in, we're speaking with Heidi Boghossian about her book, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. Well, Heidi, what are your thoughts on the way people have essentially given away their lives and minds to social media without considering the wider consequences?
Jeff, I think what's happened is technology has really accelerated with such an intense pace that laws and actually an understanding of privacy as it is now really defined in our new universe of information, we need to have the laws and protections catch up with technological developments. That's the problem. People are so accustomed to doing most of their business online that they may not read the customer agreement policies. They may not know when they sign up for an electronic gadget that they're basically giving the companies the right to access this information. So I think we need to have public education, let people know the very many ways that there are portals into their information, and hope that the courts start making decisions that protect traditional notions of privacy. For example, we know that the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution protects against unreasonable government searches and seizures. Now, you may have a drone, for example, hovering over a community, monitoring what's going on. We don't know what the laws are about that, because it's one thing to say that police need a warrant to go into your home and look for something, or to get a GPS device to follow your car. But we haven't really dealt with long periods of surveillance also following you from point A to B, or what you're doing in your house or in your yard. So I think there's a lot of new terrain that needs to be really brought into discussion. Policymakers need to examine the consequences, listen to their constituents, and we need to have a public dialogue about all of this.
It seems to me somebody paying attention to this would have had foresight to seeing that these breaches in privacy and the data collection being used, especially these particular companies profit from data collection. And really interesting the way legislators and Congress just drags its feet at this point, while corporations make massive profits on collecting personal data and trading it and bundling.
But Jeff, you've actually started to answer your own question. Why have policymakers not enacted protections before we start using and relying on this equipment? The reason is that we have a revolving door between big business and the government. We have a state of so-called a war on terror, essentially a perpetual war. Now, that war sustains big business. The government has become reliant on outsourcing to private contractors to do about 70% of its intelligence gathering. And you've got to understand that we've seen a market created by private business to make the government feel that this is a necessary component, that surveillance will keep us safe. And I think that the spying we're seeing is seamlessly connected to both military intelligence, even intervention abroad. We created the Department of Homeland Security and intelligence coordinating entities called fusion centers that encourage collaboration between the different branches of the U.S. military, many government agencies, and most importantly, profit-making businesses that store, collect, and then use information on our own citizens, in many cases to deem them enemies of the state. When we saw how quickly the drone lobbyist pushed to get drones approved for use over civilian skies last year, forcing the Federal Aviation Administration to approve it before proper safeguards were put in place, as you've said. That's just one example of how a lot of money by a powerful lobbying industry run by big business really, I think, runs roughshod over government policies and shows that there is no lack of oversight and accountability. It doesn't make sense to bring these drones into domestic airspace until we've, you know, developed testing sites, coordinated with local entities and the FAA. It's a rush to service big business. And that applies, I think, to all levels of surveillance, be it from the lowly surveillance camera on a city corner to different kinds of biometric identification and other technologies that we're seeing more and more coming into daily lives. I mean, if you go to a hospital, they'll say, to avoid delays, you want to see the doctor faster, scan your palm, scan your retina, that kind of thing. They're using them with police departments. So in a perfect society, of course, we would have safeguards in place. But what we really have, I think, is corporations driving our addiction to personal devices.
Thanks for answering that, Heidi. I appreciate that. You mentioned fusion centers. I saw the story the other day. Fusion centers. Department of Homeland Security creates new fusion centers taking control of local police. Now, something caught my attention in this story, the reference to a white paper presented in 2012 to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. In that report, the Department of Homeland Security is encouraged to embark on a, quote, evolving mission away from the ostensible purpose of fighting terrorism toward becoming the administrator of an enormous domestic intelligence agency resulting from an integration of the country's local and state law enforcement agencies. Moving away from the war on terror, which started the surveillance state to begin with. And it reminds me, on a smaller level, the example of assembling surveillance cameras during the New York City Marathon for continuous, unbroken visual monitoring. Did they take those cameras down afterward? Probably not. So they set up this apparatus for a reason. For your protection, for your security, for national security, they leave it up, even after the threat is gone.
That's an excellent point, Jeff. We've seen that on many different levels. When local law enforcement agencies, for example, apply for federal funding, be it from the Department of Homeland Security or other funding entities, to supplement their departments. We saw this in Tampa, Florida, a year and a half ago for the Republican National Convention. Tampa applied for and got funding for a tank, citing many anarchists coming to town for the RNC, expecting violence. What they do is they get equipment in advance of a particular event, and then they keep it. It becomes part of their arsenal, as it were, of police accoutrement. And we're seeing more and more, as with everything, the militarization, both of police departments and basically any kind of law enforcement response to First Amendment protected activities from ordinary citizens. But I wanted to address what you started talking about, which is fusion centers. In 2012, the U.S. Senate questioned the very relevance of fusion centers, examining how they were functioning, and noted their waste. They conducted a 2-year investigation that found that fusion centers yielded intelligence, and I'm quoting here, of uneven quality, oftentimes shoddy, rarely timely, at a cost of somewhere between $289 million and $1.4 billion since 2003. So that's 9 years, 2003 to 2012, almost $1.5 billion, and not really yielding effective coordination as they were intended to do. We have to ask ourselves, is it making us any safer?
It's not. So there's that question. And the question I look at also is, this is what all those dystopian novels in the 50s were telling you about. There is a plan that is being followed through on. This seems to me that they're using excuses such as security, convenience, and the war on terror to implement this system. Do you often hear that?
I think we all hear that. I want to quote from one of my heroes, and that's best-selling author James Bamford. Because Mr. Bamford reported in the 1980s, he was the person who actually revealed the existence of the National Security Agency. And he describes the NSA's Terrorist Identity Data Mart environment, or TIDE, a database that's used to store names gathered from the federal eavesdropping programs. He calls it a disaster. And has said, and I talk about this a little bit in Spying on Democracy, that the advent of digital communications and the kind of mass storage you just referenced, coupled with another thing you referenced, a failure of law and policy to keep abreast of technological advancements, the entire world's knowledge is stored, but not a single word is understood. It yields the capacity to make tyranny total in America. He talks about how the information stored in government databases such as TIDE is collected with the cooperation of corporations. We knew this decades before because when the counterintelligence program of J. Edgar Hoover or COINTELPRO was revealed in the early 1970s, Senator Frank Church, who chaired the Church Committee, which enacted restrictions on how the FBI could spy on individuals in America, politically and otherwise, Senator Church said that the NSA, unchecked, had the power to also create tyranny in this country. So you have Bamford Church and others using that word decades ago, not knowing really how sophisticated technology was going to be so quickly. And I think we have to realize that it's technology, it's also the internet. The internet happened, it's transformed all of our lives. Some say it's the greatest invention ever. And I think that it would really be impossible for lawmakers to have kept up with the fast pace that the internet really evolved and how quickly it opened all of our worlds. And at the same time, we're seeing the Obama administration and others try to really control the free flow of information. I think the internet to them represents a threat because, as I'm sure your listeners know, Jeff, it means that we can share truth and knowledge to others without relying on the corporate media, the corporate-owned media, and the messages that the government and corporations want us to live by.
Very good point, Heidi. Really appreciate that. I want to go through a list of stories, just recent stories, and it gives you an idea of what is taking place right now. The city bikes have a little camera in them, according to this one website, behind the front plate of the bicycle. So there's one. Here's an alternate article. How I exposed undercover cop spying on peaceful protesters. Here's another story. High-end stores use facial recognition tools to spot VIPs. That's another convenience marketing strategy. In chilling ruling, Chevron granted access to activists' private internet data. Common dreams. Eric Schmidt interview, quote, "You have to fight for your privacy or you will lose it." Here's another headline, New York Times. Deciding who sees students' education data, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in bloom. Here's another one. Warning, schools watch students on the internet around the clock. That's New York Times. That was the end of October that came out. Here's another headline. Obama administration rushes, quote, "creepy black box mandate." Here's another one. Judge stops school from expelling girl who refused to wear a tracking device. Here's another one. Baltimore announces citywide surveillance rollout that records passenger conversations on city buses. It makes me think about what's going on with this data being used in courts. Can private conversations and email collected by the NSA and corporations be used against a defendant in court?
It already is, Jeff. Secret evidence.
Could a judge secretly review that data, and that might affect the sentencing decision?
Anything that is deemed in the interest of national security can and is being used against individuals secretly and otherwise. It's a huge problem. It goes to the nature of our justice system, which right now lacks transparency. And you mentioned the FISA courts earlier. We have former FISA judges saying they had no respect in essence, for the way the government was interpreting the FISA amendments and trying to sort of mass gather data, really, I think, perverting the safeguards that are supposed to be in place. And what we're seeing in general is the doing away with protections that curb FBI and other spying on individuals, and really giving way to a belief that when an agent says he or she has a good faith belief that an investigation should be opened, well, that's fine. That's no oversight. That's not protecting our individual rights. It leaves too much up to the discretion of the individual agent and their likes or dislikes. Jeff, I want to say one thing. You mentioned city bikes, and I just can't let that example go without commenting that city bikes, to me, represents a wonderful example of how corporations and the government really try to suppress activism in this country. And New York City provides a perfect example. We had the monthly bicycle ride Critical Mass taking place that in 2004, during the Republican National Convention here, Ray Kelly, when he became commissioner in 2002, went to a judge and said, "I want to get rid of the so-called Hanshu Consent Decree, which protects activists from unnecessary and overreaching spying at the hands of the police." He basically said, "We have a Republican convention coming up. I want to go after the activists." And that's what he did. They infiltrated bicycle rides. They used a Fuji NYPD blimp to spy on them. They had infiltrators, agents provocateurs. They arrested people. They harassed them. This was bicyclists and other environmentalists trying to get more alternatives to motorized transportation in the city. Years later, what do we see but City Bike with their blue bicycles emblazoned with the name City Bike, which is just like Citibank, roving the streets, but that came at the expense of really curtailing the First Amendment rights bicyclists and others enjoyed. The laws were changed by the police department, mind you, so that groups of over 50 couldn't be together in the city. So that's an example of corporations really taking over and claiming credit for making the city more pedestrian friendly, but they subverted entire movements in doing so. Silencing of any do-it-yourself culture versus those who really abide by the corporate status quo.
Now, you know a lot about this area, Heidi. The chilling of free speech and dissent in this country as a result of this massive surveillance. Can you give some examples of how surveillance affects dissent right now?
Well, anyone who's been to a protest in the last 15 years knows that you're going to see legions of police in riot gear with so-called less lethal munitions. And you run the risk of serious bodily harm if you just want to take your message to the streets. Not to mention that you'll likely be penned in a so-called no speech, a free speech zone. I slipped and said no speech because usually these free speech zones are blocks away from wherever the event is that you want your placards to be seen and read by. So it's become often a dangerous proposition just to go out and exercise your First Amendment protections. Plus, we also see the privatization of open public spaces. And I think that Occupy Wall Street drew attention to this. Many people didn't know that in large cities such as New York, San Francisco, and others, there are arrangements made with large banks and other corporations to basically take over parks and install a set of specific rules about how you can interact and use that space so that traditional First Amendment fora such as parks, streets, open spaces are now in many times run by corporations. You'll see private security guards guarding a lot of those spaces. And whether we're conscious of it or not, we start to abide by the corporate rules. We start to behave ourselves because we know that if we do something creative or different, engage in some kind of civil disobedience or street theater, you're probably going to be arrested, but no doubt you'll be monitored by corporations and police. And how does that affect us? It makes us change the way we interact. It makes us change the way we talk. The things that we dare to do, especially when we're moved to bring a message to the public that we're upset with something, that a corporation has done a wrong, that the government has overreached. So it really constricts democracy. It constricts free speech. We see that the media is often kept out of large events. We're under the control of the corporate state.
Now, the wild card in the description of suppressing dissent with surveillance is what happened in Egypt. If you were to take it on face value, those activists under 35 using social media, the surveillance didn't quell the uprising at all. It seemed to me that the more people that joined together, the more empowered they felt. Do you think that that's what we have as a population in our tactics of activism and protest?
Let me use the Occupy Wall Street example because there are similarities. A movement was quickly born, clearly facilitated by quick online communication. People came from all over the world, not only to the United States, but to other countries in spontaneous, well-organized gatherings. I think that terrified the powers that be in this country because we have the Department of Homeland Security. We've learned through Freedom of Information Act requests by the D.C.-based Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and others, meeting with, I would call them stakeholders, banks, financial businesses across the country from Texas to California to New York to Alaska, in advance of the first Occupy encampment, telling them that they should be careful. There might be violent protesters coming to town. And then we saw orchestrated shutdowns of the encampments across the country. And we know that different mayors talked to DHS and police departments were in constant touch. We had a very well orchestrated, and I've got to say, Jeff, I said that once and someone said, you're sounding too pro-police. What I mean is we had a well-orchestrated corporate law enforcement dynamic that was intent on shutting down free speech. They could not let Occupy Wall Street flourish and run along its natural course here. It was too dynamic. It was engaging too many people with common messages of the disparities in wealth and economic injustice in this country. And that was too powerful because that could do perhaps what organizing without the internet could attempt to do, but wouldn't have the reach. So I think that you're right. On the one hand, we saw things in Egypt that might not have been possible without electronic organizing.
The more people that got involved, it seemed to not matter how much anyone was being surveilled. It's, yeah, we're being looked at. So what? Here we are in our masses. Now what?
Well, now what is the question? Because yes, there's a certain point where people get exhilarated and don't care, perhaps, that they're being monitored because there's power in the people. And that's, of course, what we hope for in terms of affecting any kind of social change. You need the people in the streets. And if we're going to have social change, obviously we need the courtroom fights, we need the people in the streets, we need messages to legislators, we need a big sea change in terms of how we think this government is to be run. The government should be of the people, for the people, by the people. Right now we're seeing by the corporations, by law enforcement. So those movements that you reference gave a glimmer of hope to so many. Meanwhile, there was a lot of infiltration going on. There was tons of spying, as we know, tons of data gathering. And I think that what that does is show that if there's another surge of public activity, people are going to have to rise above the fact that they're being surveilled, infiltrated, monitored, harassed, spied on, and persist nevertheless.
And that's the wonderful work that the National Lawyers Guild does to teach people that these tactics are being used against them, and it helps them recognize it so they don't get ensnared or trapped in these ridiculous situations.
You remind me, Jeff, that a group from D.C., the corporate watchdog group Essential Information, started by Ralph Nader, recently, in the last week or so, issued a report on how corporations spy on nonprofit organizations. And I think that's especially telling of our society because so much of social change is done by grassroots organizations. And with the rise of the corporate state, unfortunately, you often see these organizations struggling to survive. Now we're finding out many of them have been infiltrated, monitored, and disrupted.
Well, at this point, the price of technology in this digital age is too steep for the intrusion on personal privacy that's become a business in itself. But Heidi, you give really good examples of hope in your book, Spying on Democracy. Can you give us a couple of those?
I felt it was important because the subject can be gloomy to many people when you're trying to provide an overview of how we're spied on. But several examples stuck out to me. One of them, I call it denying drones. In 2013, a mayor of Seattle, Mayor Mike McGinn, in response to protests from privacy advocates and community members, actually ordered the local police department to abandon its plan to deploy two Dragonflyer X6 drones that they obtained through a federal grant, much as we discussed earlier. The residents in Seattle objected. The mayor listened. That was a positive example. We have high school sophomore Andrea Hernandez, who refused to wear a new ID card that her school district in San Antonio, Texas issued. Why? It had radio frequency identification or RFID chips embedded in it. Now, the school district said it was to track attendance. But the interesting news is, although she didn't win the right to stay in that school because she refused to wear the ID tag, they said she could transfer. I read recently that they've actually abandoned that policy in much of the school district. So that was a huge success. And then I also like to mention...
On her noncompliance.
Her noncompliance and drawing attention to it. The group, the Rutherford Institute, which is a civil liberties organization who represented her, was involved in that case. They were also involved in a case where yet another young person who was being forced to take part in a biometric palm reader program in the public school system in Maryland, in Carroll County, the father brought a suit. And this was to shorten lunch lines in the school cafeteria. You'd scan your palm. But in 2012, the Carroll County Superintendent of Schools announced that the district was going to cancel the installation of biometric equipment in the rest of its 43 schools. So that was a huge success. And I mentioned groups like the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, because one of the things that I think is really insidious in terms of breeding new consumers is the kind of advertising online to children that we see by, you know, Walt Disney, Coca-Cola, McDonald's. And there are other groups, many of them, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, just wonderful groups doing work to really curb the full throttle assault on civil liberties by the surveillance state.
It's going to require eternal vigilance by people to pay attention to this every single day in almost every action they take. Heidi Boghossian, author of Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance, the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, and co-host of Law and Disorder, thank you so much for being on the show.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. See you next week, Monday, 10 p.m.